Every single human being, more so the kiddies and teens that we're talking about today, their value is inherent and it is linked to their perspective, their creativity, and their identity. That is what I would love the world to know.
This is a Baby Brunch podcast. So today on Parents and Baby Brunch, we are talking about neurodiversity and ADHD, what it really means, and also how it shows up in our children. What we're also talking about is how parents, as well as schools, can better understand and just support our children. There's so many questions that came through that said, Ilana, our kids are in schools, our teachers do not know how to understand our children. So we want to help and support you as our children learn and experience this world differently. My name is Ilana Afrika Brennenkamp, and you can also find this and many other podcasts on babybrunch.co.za.
This podcast is supported by Epimax, the dermatologist recommended skincare range specifically formulated to hydrate, soothe, and protect. Whether it's dry skin, sensitive skin, or just everyday moisture, Epimax has a solution for everybody. Fragrance-free, hypoallergenic, and suitable for all ages. Curaprox aims to create 1 billion healthy smiles. A healthy mouth means a healthy body and mind, creating better health for you. Great oral health starts from day one. It's never too early to start. Curaprox Baby gets your child on the right path of starting healthy oral care habits for life.
Let's dive right in. What does neurodivergent actually mean, and what do you wish that our parents understood better about this word?
Answering our questions today is Dr. Gago Matsibula. He is no stranger to Parent and Baby Brunch. He's been on our podcast before, and today we want to thank him for his time as we are unpacking this. Doctor, thanks for joining us on Baby Brunch.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So let's talk ADHD. I mean, it seems to be everywhere lately. So if we say ADHD, are we overdiagnosing it? Is it underdiagnosed? Is it something that we finally need to understand better?
So what we have is actually an uncovering, is what I prefer to call it. Why do I say uncovering? The science has improved, the research has improved, the language has improved. So we're talking about it more. We're now able to better diagnose kiddies and teens who do have ADHD. And I know it does seem as if, with everyone talking about ADHD, it seems like it's an epidemic. I prefer the term uncovering. We're talking about it more, and we're able to give kiddies and teens who need that much needed support that support. In the past, that support was not there. Kiddies would be called lazy, bad, stupid, silly, or slow, which I really detest. And what we would see is those kiddies would not get the support that they need. More often than not, they would be relegated to the back of the class, or there would be detentions or suspensions or even expulsions. So it's a much needed uncovering.
So would we say there's different types of ADHD? I mean, how does it really show up in everyday life, especially in children who are not hyperactive? Are there different types of ADHD?
100%. So I think I'll start off with what we see being normal, in heavy square quotes. So it's developmentally normal for kiddies that are about 5 or 4. It's normal for them to have difficulty sitting still, waiting for their turn. It's normal for them to blurt out and interrupt when people are talking. It's absolutely normal. But ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, basically means we've got a kiddie who struggles with hyperactivity or impulsivity, and I'll talk about what that means, or they struggle with their attention. So starting with the hyperactive kiddie, they can't sit still. There's a lot of activity happening there. They're fidgety, they'll leave their desk or their table when they should not. They walk around, they have a lot of energy. It almost looks and feels as if they're constantly on the go, They seems like they can't get tired, and it seems like they've got this energy source that is just infinite. It's always going. We also have impulsivity as well, where they'll butt in, they'll disturb other people when they're talking, or they'll blurt out answers in class. We may also have what we call emotional dysregulation. And those are just big words for the kiddie is going to have really big feelings in response to something that shouldn't ordinarily elicit such feelings, or it'll take them quite some time to settle down after they've had a disappointment. Then on the other end, we're going to have the kiddie that struggles with attention. So this kiddie struggles to sustain their attention. So it seems as if they daydream. It appears as if they're not listening. They misplace stuff. They're forgetful. It takes them longer to complete a task, or they'll start a task and not finish it. They'll make a lot of really small mistakes, or they miss the details. And that's what we see in inattentive ADHD. ADHD is present from childhood. It's lifelong. It causes difficulties in several settings. So it could be at school, could be at home. It causes problems with friends. So friends tend not to like it when their friend butts in when they're talking and just talks over them or doesn't give them a chance to talk. And it can be really distressing for the kiddie or the teen and for the parents as well.
How early can ADHD be identified? I mean, is there a warning sign? Is there something that we should be looking out for? Is there something that parents or educators can look out for?
So we are able to make reliable diagnosis from about the ages of 6 upwards. That's when, the symptoms that we see can be accurately diagnosed. And there are a set of questions that we are going to ask parents relating to either impulsivity or difficulties with hyperactivity or difficulties with inattention, like we've just spoken about now. If a child is about 5 or 4 or less, if the symptoms are mild, if we only see the symptoms in one setting, like at home, or the symptoms look to be getting better, then we would say, don't worry about it. You can attend to it later. But if the symptoms are really distressing to the child, if there's persistent concerns from the teachers, if the parents are overwhelmed, or there's safety concerns like little Sipho climbing on a really high tree and almost falling and hurting him or herself, or if we're having emotional dysregulation or these really big feelings, then in that case, we say rather go see a clinician and let's get an accurate diagnosis made. While there are certain questionnaires that we find on the internet, and I know that many of the people listening most likely have checked out one or two of these, it's really preferable for them to rather come in to see a clinician so that we can exclude certain things and to give them the accurate diagnosis for that child or that teenager.
I'm just curious. So, do the symptoms appear differently for boys and girls?
Yes, they do. Yes, they absolutely do. So in boys, the symptoms tend to be externalized. So that's where we see the running, the climbing, the jumping, the butting in. We see that predominantly. So that's the hyperactive, impulsive presentation of ADHD. In little girls, the symptoms tend to be internalized. So that's where we tend to see more of the inattentive stuff. So appearing as if they're not paying attention, missing details, making mistakes, seeming as if they're reluctant to attend to things like homework. We tend to see those in little girls. But even though the presentation might be different, we do know that these core symptoms will be present equally in both boys and girls. It's just that the presentation tends to be a bit different.
One of the questions that we received online is it us as parents that's linked to it? So, for instance, parents wonder whether they have caused it. So, is ADHD something that's linked to, let's say, our stress, our lifestyle? Is it diet related? Is it stress related? Did we do something wrong?
This is my favorite question, because this is a question that allows me to try and find out what the parents might be thinking and what they might be feeling, and if there's any what we call inappropriate guilt. So that's where the parent, feels bad about stuff that they really shouldn't feel bad about. Or it gives me an opportunity to find out if the parent is blaming themselves over stuff that they really shouldn't blame themselves about. So to answer this question, allow me, please, to bore your audience with a bit of biology 101. So we have little Johnny, and little Johnny has 50% of his DNA from mum and 50% of his DNA from dad. And this DNA, in essence, is like a recipe or a set of instructions that tells the brain how to develop, how to grow, and how to ultimately work. And so what I'm trying to say is genes play a major role in the coming about or development of ADHD. Things like vaccines, the usage of medication when mom is pregnant, normal stress when mom is pregnant, working normally while pregnant, all of these things have not been shown to cause ADHD. We do know that this really significant genetic component tends to interact with certain risk factors. And these risk factors do not mean that when they are there, baby is going to develop ADHD, but rather what these risk factors mean is that there is a slight increase in the likelihood of the baby being born with ADHD in combination with genes. So what are some of these risk factors? We do know that if mom is really, really unwell, or what we call a severe maternal infection, that's a risk factor. If the baby is born extremely prematurely, that's a risk factor as well. Or if dad is quite advanced in age when little Johnny is conceived, that is a risk factor as well. We have risk factors working with genes, with other risk factors and other genetic components to then bring about ADHD. So there's no single cause of ADHD, and ADHD can't be turned on by something that a parent does.
Is it something that we can grow out of? So let's say you were diagnosed with ADHD as a child or as a teenager.
Yes, it does. So we do know that ADHD does evolve. Remember how we spoke about impulsivity, hyperactivity, and difficulties with attention. So the hyperactivity in childhood is externalized, like we spoke about in little boys. We do know that as the child grows and becomes a teenager and an adult, that hyperactivity goes undercover, as it were. So it goes from being externalized to becoming internalized. And that takes the form of this sense of internal restlessness, or a brain that just doesn't want to switch off. And what we see there is they will say that, "Doc, I might be tired, I'm trying to go to bed," but the brain is just not playing along. It's just thinking about this and then thinking about that. And that's what tends to happen to hyperactivity. With impulsivity, it goes from outbursts on the playfield. Again, it also becomes internalized. And that can take the form of an individual having difficulties with their finances. And that takes the form of spending money impulsively. Or they tend to struggle with long-term planning. The inattentive one, that tends to persist in that manner. So we'll have a teenager and an adult who struggles with organization, who struggles with focus, who struggles with attention to details. We also do know that ADHD waxes and wanes. So you might have an adult who feels that, "Nope, I've outgrown my ADHD," but we do know that the symptoms are still there, and they tend to emerge in certain stressful times, like enrolling in university or starting a new job, or when they're working, there's this really big project that comes about. Then there we are going to see the symptoms coming about. It is only in 10% of people where they truly outgrow ADHD, and that means the symptoms permanently, completely, totally resolve. But for the 90%, the symptoms are there. So it is lifelong, as we mentioned when we started.
I want to talk schools. So, where do schools get it right, and where do schools get it wrong when it comes to neurodivergent children?
So neurodivergence is a big word that's made up of two smaller words. The first is neuro, relating to the brain, and divergence, which is self-explanatory. And neurodivergence basically means that we've got a brain that develops differently from what could be called typical, and it processes information and interacts with the world in its unique way. It's really important to mention that neurodivergence does not mean a defect. It simply means difference. It's not an illness in the classical sense of the word, but rather it is a term that compels us to ask, what does the child need instead of what is wrong with the child? And the term neurodivergence, lastly, is like an umbrella term that encompasses ADHD, which we'll have a chat about today, as well as autism and dyslexia and other conditions as well. It tends to come on in childhood and is lifelong. So it's there with us from the moment we're born until we're old and gray.
Is there something that teachers should understand? Like, let's say the child is disciplined, you know, you're a well child at school, but at home, everything falls apart.
Yes, indeed. So there's something that's called masking, and I think that the term kind of gives the concept away. There's something called masking that kiddies and teens with neurodivergence and ADHD that they use. And masking basically means that the child pretends to be one of those children that can sit still. The child pretends to be able to follow lessons and instructions like other kiddies, but at great emotional cost. And by the time the entire school day has gone by, for that little boy, that little girl, it's similar to an 8-hour marathon of putting up pretenses. And so by the time they get home, that emotional battery or that emotional bandwidth is all but used up. And so when they get home and home is their safe space, then they'll have a breakdown. We'll have the tears, and we'll have the unhappiness. And this is not because the child is acting out or is being naughty or is being spoiled, but the child is just expressing the sense of frustration from having to mask for 8 hours, 5 days a week, 4 weeks a month throughout the school term.
How important is parent training and what does it involve?
So first prize for me would be to consult with a clinician. And the clinician will not only make the diagnosis in terms of the little child or the teenager, but the clinician will also give advice in terms of what can be done to help the child. And speaking on training, the clinician will be able to guide the parent about where they can access the training and which resources, which reliable resources that they can access on the internet. While information is readily available on the internet, unfortunately, some of it is not accurate, and that can be really dangerous. So, clinician first, and let's have the clinician guide the parent in terms of resources. I do know that the South African Depression and Anxiety Group has got a really, really good website with really, really good resources. Are there benefits to parent training? Yes. There's going to be improved understanding of what the child has. There's going to be less stress on the parent and on the child. And ultimately, and this is the golden prize for me, there's going to be an improved bond between the parent and the child. So with the training, the parent will then be able to move away from, but what's wrong with my child, to what does my child need? And what can I do to make things easier for my child?
Is there a way that we can help families and those around us? Can we help them think about ADHD and medication use in a balanced way?
Indeed, I think this is my second favorite question because it allows me to attend to some myths that are there. Look, I totally get it as a doctor. You know, when we look at our child as our teenager, we view them as being, can I say, pristine, and we don't want to sully them with chemicals. But here's the thing. Sometimes medication is needed, and medication doesn't change your child, doesn't make your child a zombie, doesn't make your child woozy, doesn't make your child addicted or dependent on the medication. It doesn't change your child's personality. It doesn't do that at all. And those are all myths. What the medication is it is a tool in a basket of tools that we can implement to help the child. The medication helps the child with their attention, with their impulsivity, with their hyperactivity as well. And this medication can be changed if need be. It can be stopped if it's not agreeing with the child. And as long as there's medical supervision, it is one of the safest and one of the most researched aspects of child and adolescent psychiatry. Are there side effects? I might hear someone saying, yes, every single medication does have certain side effects. And the clinician should talk to you about the side effects, and they should tell you about how those side effects can be managed. Briefly, we do know that some of the medications are going to hurt the child's appetite. For some kiddies, they might be a bit more irritable, but there has to be close monitoring by the clinician and the parent with the ultimate aim that little Johnny or little Vusi or little Elana is able to do well in school and not to develop low self-esteem. And I guess we'll get into that in the next few minutes.
If we think beyond medication, what are practical strategies that will make a difference at home and also at school?
So first step, let's educate ourselves. And I'm really thankful to you, Ilana, for this platform, because this is where parents are going to learn about these things. So the first step is to learn and to understand and to realize that symptoms are not behavior, but they're just what I call them, symptoms. So what can parents do? There are small things that we can do. We could have external reminders. We could have checklists, maybe on the fridge door, or maybe in the bathroom, or maybe in the child's bedroom. And these are going to help the child to remember things that need to be done. We can set up things like what I call a launch pad. So a launch pad, shortly, is a set place where books are kept, where bags are kept, where sports equipment is kept, where shoes are kept, so that in the morning when we're leaving, we know where things are. Then we can help them by breaking down the instructions that we give them. So instead of saying something like, go clean your room, break that instruction down into chunks. Put your socks away, or make your bed, or put your toys away. Those are the small things that we can put into place for our children. Then things like sleep. Sleep is really important. Let's ensure that we have 1 hour of wind down time where there are no screens. Let's make sure that the diet is as healthy as possible. And no, I'm not saying let's not give our kiddies and teens treats from time to time. Those are absolutely fine. But let's ensure that the bulk of the child's nutritional intake is a healthy diet. If we can put these small things into play, we do and can improve the long-term prognosis and outcome.
As an expert, if there's anything that you can change in society, understanding neurodivergent children, what would it be?
So the one thing, if I could get on a world stage somewhere, the one thing that I would say would be, it is absolutely imperative that we teach children that their value is not linked to their ability to sit still, but it is linked to their creativity, their personality, and their resilience. In other words, it is extremely important for us to teach our kiddies and our teens that their value is not linked in doing, but in being. Society, unfortunately, places a premium on doing, which then brings about a question. When the person is unable to do, are we then saying that person is less than? And the answer is no. Every single human being, more so the kiddies and teens that we're talking about today, their value is inherent and it is linked to their perspective, their creativity, and their identity. That is what I would love the world to know.
It's also a message from a mommy, and she says, "Should I be looking to have my child screened? We're still wetting the bed at night, and he's already six."
He's six. So in that instance, again, I would ask for that parent to have their little one be seen by a clinician. There are several questions that are coming up for me. For an example, is there a point where the little one stopped wetting the bed and then started wetting the bed again? Has there been some changes in the family? Has there been some traumatic stuff in the family? Did the child go through all of their milestones nicely as would be expected? And I guess when all of these questions are adequately answered, then most likely the diagnosis and some form of treatment would come about. But yes, I think that parent should also go to see a clinician as well.
Here's another one that came through from Aileen. She says, "How do we help ASD and the variations of the diagnosis? And how do we assist a child in school without them being labeled as remedial?"
ASD, that sounds like that parent is talking about autism spectrum disorder. That is also a form of neurodivergence, onset in childhood. I would encourage that parent to seek out a clinician's assistance, please. Autism briefly relates to a child that struggles with social interactions or communication and an insistence on doing things in a set way. And if that is not attended to, it can hurt that child's self-esteem. It can open the door to things like anxiety and depression or being understood. So the short answer to that question is please rather seek out a clinician's intervention there.
Well, thank you so much for answering our questions on, I think, this very important conversation.
Thank you. Only a pleasure. Anytime. Thank you.
And remember, if you still have any questions, you're welcome to inbox us, babybrunch.co.za. Also follow us online on social media. And for more support on neurodiversity and all of our other podcasts, you can visit babybrunch.co.za.
Thanks so much for listening to this podcast. A quick thanks to our support. This podcast is supported by Epimax, the dermatologist-recommended skincare range specifically formulated to hydrate, soothe, and protect. Whether it's dry skin, sensitive skin, or just everyday moisture, Epimax has a solution for everybody. Fragrance-free, hypoallergenic, and suitable for all ages. Curaprox aims to create 1 billion healthy smiles. A healthy mouth means a healthy body and mind, creating better health for you. Great oral health starts from day one. It's never too early to start. Curaprox Baby gets your child on the right path of starting healthy oral care habits for life.